For WHUS Stores, Radio for the People, I'm Dori Smith. Last time we aired a two-part series featuring a talk by journalist Dar Jamail, just back from Iraq. We will feature more of that lecture next time as we take a detailed look at the January elections and the new Iraqi government. For an audio tape of the entire lecture by Dar Jamail in Boston, April 25th, 2005, write to me at theshockvote@yahoo.com. This time, decorated U.S. veteran Kevin Benderman and his wife Monica Benderman talk about their struggle to get the U.S. military to grant conscientious objector status to this 10-year veteran. BendermanDefense.org to follow along as you listen to this broadcast. In late April, after a lengthy struggle, Sergeant Kevin Benderman was denied his request for conscientious objector status, and the U.S. military intends to court-martial him May 11th at Fort Stewart. Benderman is pursuing another request for CO status, and he and his wife are continuing to write letters to the military and to others they think can help Kevin prove he is a conscientious objector, committed to ending war instead of fighting it. The couple's story has become symbolic to many USGIs facing stop loss, longer terms in Iraq than they thought possible, and having deep misgivings about the reality of this war. Kevin and Monica Benderman were still relative newlyweds when the U.S. invaded Iraq and Kevin was deployed. Monica took us back to that time.
We actually were married about 3 months before he was deployed, and spent that time just, you know, getting acquainted, talking about what was going on and feelings and all. But we also knew that not knowing at the time, we believed he would probably be deployed for a year or more. And so, we just did everything we could think of that you would want to fit in, so you basically would have no regrets. And there were times when you kind of broke down because you knew what was coming. It was the initial deployment and the initial invasion, so, you know, not having any awareness of what might be like or what was coming, you know, I think we were scared, but it was what we were doing because it's what we do. And didn't really have an awareness at the time of exactly how much of an impact it was going to have.
And at what point did Kevin start to really have second thoughts about the U.S. military operation he was seeing unfold and its impact on civilian Iraqis and also USGIs like himself?
Well, I think we were concerned with it. A lot of the veterans that I took care of would talk about their experiences, and they would just shake their head and say, I can't believe we're going to do this again. I think Kevin and I talked about it. Well, I know that Kevin and I talked about it leading up to his deployment, talked about our concerns about it. You have doubts. You know, you don't know. You just know what you suspect, and you know what you feel, but you just can't really put a finger on it until you go through it. We talked to some of the soldiers. I know when I was there at Fort Hood watching them get ready to leave, some of the soldiers would come up, and they were apprehensive. I don't think anybody really was 100% sure that what they were doing was right. I don't think any soldier in his right mind will ever tell you that war is a good thing. You know, I mean, it's just, you read in many places where soldiers would say that, you know, no one hates war more than a soldier. But not having all the answers, not knowing anything except what you're told, you have to find it out for yourself. You can't just take somebody else's word for it. And when Kevin went to Iraq, I started getting letters back where you could tell that he was questioning things more based on what he was seeing. He didn't talk a lot about what he was seeing, but just his actions and his reactions and his comments kind of, you know, gave away that he was thinking. And then as he came back, our lives were tied up with getting moved, getting kids acquainted with their stepdad and getting settled in a new military installation. Once that settled down and everybody kind of calmed down from that hype of combat, being in combat, and settled back into their lives, I think that's when he really began to say, you know, I saw this. I don't want to do it again. I'm not going to.
Tell us about some of what Kevin has been saying as he makes his case before the U.S. military. At this point, he's been denied conscientious objector status under Article 600-43. Talk about what's going on with these Army regulations and some of what Kevin Benderman, your husband, has been saying to the U.S. military.
Well, he wants out. He served his time. It's not like he's just saying, you know, I thought about this, I enlisted, but I only want to do it after all. He knows firsthand. He's seen carnage. He's seen death. He's seen destruction. He's smelled it, tasted it, he's walked through it. And having seen it, he knows he does not want to be party to it. And that's what he's telling them. You know, I just don't want it. He's seen what it does to the other soldiers, the younger soldiers. He is older, so there's a wisdom about him and an ability to look around and perceive differently than what others might perceive. He's seen the way the soldiers react. He's seen what the young kids have to do. It's not what kids their age should be doing. It's not part of the normal growth process for emotions and, you know, becoming an adult. They're being thrown into something that they have no business being thrown into. And he sees that and knows that it's wrong and knows that he cannot put himself in a position of having to participate in it.
Tell us about the process and what kinds of things you two have now become involved with.
Well, first, you know, to be a soldier, you have to put your feelings away. You cannot have any humanity on the surface that anybody can touch and survive as a soldier. And so, you know, everybody in the military, that's basically what happens. They shut down. When that happens, it's just everything is black and white to them. It's, you know, well, this is a regulation. This is what we see. This is what I'm doing, and so I'm doing it. Everybody must do it. And we've seen through the process that that's part of the dehumanizing effect of war and the process of war. It's not just killing of the enemy and killing of the civilians and the innocent children. And I mean, that is obviously devastating. That's something, taking people's homes and destroying them, destroying their country, destroying everything they love. But the other side of it is, before you can destroy others, you have to destroy yourself. And that's what we've asked our soldiers to do. The parts of them that make them people, that make them human, they've had to destroy it or hide it away so deeply that sometimes you're never going to find it again in order to destroy others. And in the process of the conscientious objector application, that's what we've seen. You know, you look at people and you know somewhere deep inside these commanders, they've got a soul, they've got a humanity, they've got something there, but it's in their eyes. But it's not in their actions, it's not in their manner, because they've had to keep it hidden for so long. And when they respond to questions, when they respond to the kind of things that Kevin is posing, they don't want to listen, because for many of them, the things that he's saying are touching that humanity. But, you know, people are either afraid to admit that they have feelings, they're afraid to admit that they have humanity, or by the very fact that they're career soldiers, they can't afford to bring that out. Because, one, it might make them question what they're doing for their career, and, two, it might make them have to go through the same type of a process, and they don't know if they can face it. So, you know, that's what we're seeing. The kind of things that we hope to approach, we hope that we do reach soldiers, that there are soldiers out there who haven't gone so far away from themselves that we can't get them back. And, you know, Those are the people, the groups that we try to get out to, or the people that are trying to do the same things that we are, is let the soldiers realize that, you know, you are a human being. You volunteered to defend humanity. You didn't volunteer to give up your soul.
I listened to an interview with your husband, Kevin Benderman, on Trap Rock Peace website, and he said several times that the war is crazy, that the killing is wrong, and he certainly saw killing. But when this became really more than a philosophical debate for you and your husband, you did come in contact with a lot of other people. Tell us how your arguments have been received by the American people that have listened to the two of you as you talk about this openly and publicly, and also how GIs are receiving Kevin now.
Well, the American people as a whole, all the people that we have reached, are amazingly supportive. And when we hear others say, you can't afford to be patriotic anymore. We read a presentation this weekend where a woman cried and said, how dare you wear a red, white, and blue ribbon, and how dare you call us an American? We're ashamed of America. Well, we've met so many people and been to so many places where America's not gone, and we're not ashamed to be Americans. America isn't represented as what it is right now. But, we've met so many people across this country that are supportive, understand, listen, and even the people that speak out against Kevin to begin with, for the most part, if we stay on it long enough and say, look, we're not against what you believe, we're not against who you are, we don't want to take your beliefs away, we just want people to give us the right to have our beliefs. It's amazing how people respond to that.
Cynthia McKinney also spoke eloquently on April 28, 2005, in a speech to the House of Representatives. Talk about what it's meant to have this kind of support from members of Congress and leading peace organizations worldwide. This has become really a kind of universal discussion that you've entered into.
It is, and we're proud of that. We are so proud of that because it's what we've wanted, it's what we believed in. That you have to reach across every philosophical, political venue, religious venue, really, in order to make the healing start. When people look at everybody's differences, the differences need to be recognized because that's what brought each person to the place that they are. But then it seems like too many times people look only at the differences. And underneath all those differences, there's the same thing. And for people in Congress, for people in all these worldwide peace organizations, for them to recognize what we're trying to say and come together and allow us to represent all of them, in the manner that they have, allowing us to link them on their websites, allowing us to speak at their functions, allowing us to address their members, that's kind of, it's awesome for one thing. But at the same time, it's humbling that, that for some reason we get to be part of so many different things, but really the same thing all at one time.
We're talking again with Monica Benderman, and please do log on to BendermanDefense.org to learn more about what you can do if you would like to support this couple in their effort to talk about the moral questions surrounding the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq. Monica, you did talk about the children in some of what you have put up on this website, and you've talked about now the fact that you have children and your husband, Kevin, was coming to be their dad. How has that aspect of his witness impacted you personally, the fact that he did see children so horribly injured?
Long time ago, I made a commitment, and I made it to myself, but the commitment was that I would do everything that I could with the gifts that I've been given. I didn't earn them, I'm earning them, but to be able to help the people, children and elderly, people that for some reason don't have the voice to help themselves. And I did it by myself for a while, but of course, it's kind of tough, and you take a strong stand, and you get tired at the end of every day. When Kevin came along, it was, okay, this is good, because he was trying to do the same thing. Now we get to do it together. We're hoping that we can obviously continue to help children, we've received emails and letters and pictures, drawings and poetry that children all over this country have written to us. And we're so proud of those. We carry them with us and show them to everybody because they're young children, first graders, 12-year-olds, writing to us that know what's happening and respond to that and respond to Kevin. And that's amazing. We receive so many phone calls and emails from people at the other end of the spectrum, the veterans, Korean War veterans. Two 95-year-old sisters wrote to us and supported us. So we hear what they're telling us, and the same thing, and that drives us. At the same time, in the middle, We have the soldiers, the Marines, the Navy, and we know what they're facing, and we know how many of them are struggling with what they're facing. But the way the military sets things up, you know, you're in a little box, you can't talk about your feelings, you have to put them all away. You know, you're dishonoring your country if you fight for trying to make it stronger in positive ways. That's what they're all told. So maybe we can help in the middle also to help the family members and the soldiers see that you can defend its constitution, you can defend what it stands for. You don't have to lose yourself in the process, but you can make all of that stronger by speaking out. Yeah, maybe we'll have a few more soldiers coming out with us. We're hoping that soldiers will see, and their family members, and it's not just a hope, it is something that we're seeing happen, that they are coming to see that you don't lose your voice by volunteering to serve your country.
Now, you and Kevin are taking on some huge questions here.
Yeah.
How has it mattered that he is a 10-year veteran of the U.S. military and a decorated soldier? It would seem to me that it would be hard for the military to discount what he's been saying here. Do you think they are worried about what he's saying for that reason, that you really can't just write off Kevin Benderman?
I would expect that, you know, it's hard to discount what Kevin's saying because, one, it's honest, it's the truth. You know, and it's a firmly committed belief, and they can't really dispute anything that he's saying. You know, so what we've seen by their actions is rather than dispute it, they just simply move on from it. They ignore it, even from his conscientious objector application. As the process is pursued, as it goes through the chain of command, anybody who submits anything to Kevin's application that would go against his beliefs, if they say that they recommend disapproval, if they say that they don't believe he's sincere, that is then supposed to go back to Kevin, and he has the right to offer a rebuttal to that comment. Well, as the process happened, none of that did. Each commander, rather than write a commentary, they simply had a form letter prepared, and the commander had a choice of circling approve or disapprove of Kevin's application. They didn't give a reason. So there was nothing there to send back to Kevin for Kevin to refute. So that tells you right there that they're afraid, perhaps, or that they don't know how to handle what he's doing, or they're just hoping that he'll say, okay, I'm frustrated with this, I'm going to walk away from it. But they don't know Kevin. And, you know, he's not somebody that walks away from what he believes in. And I'm certainly not going to walk away from it. You know, I'm going to be right there with him.
Georgia Representative Cynthia McKinney speaking to the U.S. House of Representatives. I want to quote her final comment, and perhaps you'd comment on what she said here, quoting Cynthia McKinney, "Every member of our armed forces raises their hands, as do we, and take an oath, as do we, to defend the Constitution of the United States. That Constitution protects the right of conscience, including the right to conscientiously object to war as an instrument of public policy. But given the climate we face right now, asserting such a right takes real courage, and it is the exercise of that courage which makes Sergeant Benderman a hero in my book." She's not alone in calling your husband a hero, Monica. How does that make you feel?
I call him every day.
He's your
but
hero.
Then, as soon as I call him that, I make him feed the dogs or go feed the chickens.
Chickens. Okay. It sounds like a really nice lifestyle you have in Georgia and one that we can all learn something from. Thank you so much for this lesson.
Okay.
KevinBenderman.org. Sergeant Kevin Benderman is standing tall in U.S. military courtrooms as he tries to explain his decision to seek conscientious objector status. As he explains it here today, he faces court-martial scheduled for the 11th of May, and he's trying to file again as a conscientious objector after he's been rejected. Thousands of Americans from various kinds of backgrounds have taken an interest in his case. Kevin Benderman, welcome.
Well, thank you.
It's hard for soldiers that I've spoken with to come out of the kind of war you've come out of and feel good about their lives. Tell us about your journey and where you're at with it now.
Well, I guess I should start by giving you a little bit of a history about myself. And I was born in Alabama, and I was raised in Tennessee, and my family has a history that dates back to the American Revolution of military service to this country. And that's on both sides. I mean, both my grandfather served during World War I. My father served during World War II. I had an uncle in Korea. There's just been an extensive family history of military service. And so that kind of leads you to, I think, have a better picture of my mindset prior to ever being in a war. And after being in a war and seeing what it is firsthand for myself, I realized that it's not anything that we should be glamorizing and being involved in this day and age. I mean, it was really an eye-opener, because you have these images that's produced by Hollywood, and you have these images that you have in your head because, you know, of the talk that you hear and the experience that you have with other people that were in your family that served. But the reality of it is, it's the most base thing that anyone can do to each other, you know, as another human being. And so after seeing it firsthand, I had no other choice but to file for conscientious objector and say that I could no longer participate in war of any kind.
I've read, too, that some of the events that were life-changing for you in the war zone in Iraq, just talk a little bit about those first experiences and how they changed you and your view about this, the whole goal that you thought you were, you know, endeavoring to achieve in Iraq.
Well, I'd like to dispel the notion that any war is as glamorous or as great as they make it out to be, because after I initially entered military service, my father used to tell me about some of the experiences that he had when he was in World War II in France and Belgium, and I really didn't understand what he was telling me at the time. But at times he told me that he had to walk across frozen dead bodies for 5 miles before he could step off on the ground. And, you know, I listened to him as he told me these things, but until you see the kind of stuff he's talking about firsthand, you really don't, it doesn't have a full impact on what that means. And so I saw a young girl standing there along the side of the road as we were moving north through that country. And her arm was burned, severely burned with third degree, you know, all the way up to her shoulder. And she was standing there crying and begging for help. I guess the woman that was with her was her mother. And they were both begging for help, and we just couldn't stop and help them because of limited medical supplies. And that right there, you know, it tears at your heart to see a little girl that's in a war zone, that's experienced it, that's probably all she's ever experienced. And I couldn't do nothing to help her. But while I was there on the ground, I saw things that people had to do in order to, they felt that they had to do in order to survive in the situation that you were in, because you weren't sure what was going to come at you from what direction at any time it may come. And that puts a lot of stress on people. So, you know, I'm not saying that all the soldiers that are in Iraq have done things that are totally bad, but the people do things when they're under stressful situations that they wouldn't normally do. And the reason that I want to get away from war now is because of that very fact. I mean, it turns young men and women that are in the military into just heartless killers, because that's what you have to do to survive. And then you have the victims that are non-combatants that get involved in war, and they get killed, and they receive wounds, and their homes are destroyed, their way of living is destroyed. They don't have any basic necessities such as electricity, water supply, and things of that nature. And you just look at all that, and it's all, you know, you weigh it all out, and it adds up, and you say, you know what, we should not be in wars anymore, ever.
I want to call your attention back to what you wrote again about commanders who told soldiers to take actions that you disagreed with. Talk a little bit about what that was like and what kinds of things it did to your understanding of chain of command issues in the military.
Well, the incident you're referring to, I believe, is the one where my commander ordered us to shoot small children that were on the wall of the compound that we were stationed at if they climbed back up on the wall.
Yes.
I don't know that was a systematic order or anything that come directly from the chain of command. I know that that particular incident, it did happen that day. And we all looked at him like he had lost his mind. And we pretty much told him in no uncertain terms that there were no way that we were going to shoot small children. And so he turned around and went back into the building. And I'm not sure, I don't think it was a systematic order. I think he may have just been overreacting to the situation, again, because, you know, you're in a stressful situation. You're liable to say or do things that you normally wouldn't do. And thank God nobody that day listened to him as he was expressing that order. So it's really kind of hard to say. I don't think it was a systematic order that come down. But that's just some of the things that happen to people in war zones. And that's why I now feel that we should move away from war and never participate in it again.
Now, in a way, those soldiers who refused to shoot those kids were agreeing with you, weren't they? I mean, they were making their stand that human beings are more important than, let's say, carrying out that particular order on that day.
Well, yes, you could say that, because they all, and we talked about it, some of the guys that was there with me afterwards, we talked about it, and they said, you know what, this is crazy. I mean, there's no way that we can shoot children. And some of them, you know, they said, well, if they were combatant soldiers, they would have no problem firing or receiving that order, you know. But they, we all looked at each other, and he's like, we're talking about children that's, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old that were curious about, number one, they had never seen Americans. Number two, they had never seen equipment that we had. And so that was brought out the natural childish curiosity. And they were pointing and laughing, and a few of them had maybe one or two little small pebbles that they tossed across the wall. We told them to get down off the wall and not come back. You know, so you're right. I mean, as far as everyone there, humanity was more important than following that particular order. Yes.
Would you please tell our listeners what your situation is right now, and end by telling us, too, what advice do you have for someone who's listening to this broadcast who may also be facing stop-loss orders to return to Iraq and who doesn't wish to go or doesn't feel he or she doesn't feel he can go?
Well, that's a two-part question. The first one is my position that I've taken up and the things that I'm dealing with, because my conscientious objector packet has been denied by the United States Department of the Army. And I am currently working on getting another application together and resubmitting that as soon as I can. I plan to have it ready by this Friday. And I'm going to deal with whatever they come up with in order for me to be able to convince them that I am sincere, that I do not want to participate in war. And that's a decision that I have made for myself, well, along with Monica, my wife. And we are both feel that's the best thing for us to not participate in war. And as far as addressing what anyone else will or will not do, I will say to them that they have to make up their own mind about the course of action that they choose to take. I myself felt that I have taken the right course of action. But there will be consequences with that action, so you have to be 100% sure that's what you want to do. And I felt that it's more important to me to get my message across to people to not kill or participate in mass killings than to just follow orders mindlessly. It makes no sense to me.
Kevin Benderman, how can people learn more about this, and where should they go, again, if they're interested in learning about conscientious objector status?
Well, there's a number of places that they can go. The GI Rights Hotline covers a lot of conscientious objector status information, and that would be a good place to start. If they are currently in the military, I can say that is AR, that's Army Regulation 600-43, covers conscientious objection. And there's just an entire host of things that would give them information on how to go about applying. I'd say talk to their personal chaplain or their clergy in whatever church that they're in and discuss it with them.
Thanks so much for joining us, and we look forward to talking with you again.
Thank you.
Decorated U.S. Military Sergeant Kevin Benderman is a 10-year veteran. He and Monica, his wife, were still relative newlyweds when the U.S. invaded Iraq and Kevin was deployed there. The website is bendermandefense.org. For further information about obtaining conscientious objector status, try the GI Rights hotline at girights.objector.org. I'm Dori Smith. If you would like a copy of the program you've just heard, or of the special series that aired last week featuring journalist Dar Jamail, write to me at theshockvote@yahoo.com.